political leaders have come together to discuss this issue, along with representatives from countries where political leadership is not here. And it's important for you to be here, and thank you for coming. And I'm now going to turn over to Ian Shugart, who are our Assistant Deputy Minister in Department of Health, Health Canada.
Thank you, Minister.
And on my left is my colleague, Carolyn Bennett, Minister of State for Public Health for Canada.
Thank you, Minister. I will make a few comments about the scenario for the meeting. Before we get underway, you'll notice that there is a brief photo op at the this part of the meeting. When photographers are in the room, you might wish to make sure that no sensitive materials are visible on your table. The meeting is being fed by television. To the media, and for the delegates who cannot be accommodated in this room, there is also a television feed to an adjacent room where the remainder of the delegates are. If you have any need for a message to be conveyed somewhere else, there is a help desk just outside the door. The meeting will be conducted in English and French. We have made arrangements for some additional interpretation at the request of individual delegations. And the meeting plan is the chair, Mr. Desange, will make some opening comments, followed by brief statements from Dr. Lee of the World Health Organization, Dr. Diouf of the Food and Agriculture Organization, Dr. Tierman of the World Organization for Animal Health, followed by a presentation by Dr. Chan of WHO. The first three presentations will be open to the media. Dr. Chan's presentation, which will be followed by some discussion, will not. Tomorrow, following the four thematic discussions, there will be opportunity for presentations leading off the discussion, and then open discussion among ministers and delegates. We are hoping that there will be informal and spontaneous discussion as much as possible, that there won't be formal presentations by delegates. Again, if you do have information that you want to share, we would be quite happy as the Secretariat to make those available to all delegations in order to stimulate some spontaneous discussion. The meeting will have a news conference at the end, and as you know, I hope that there will be a reception and dinner beginning in the Skelton lobby just outside these doors at 6 o'clock. I'll turn it back to the chair of the meeting.
Thank you. I hope there is reception and dinner. You don't. Yes. I hope you don't hope.
There definitely is. Yes.
Good. Let me once again, on behalf of the Government of Canada, welcome you all to Canada, and to welcome you to this meeting of health ministers dedicated to building a unified front against a pandemic influenza outbreak. The fact that this meeting has brought together so many countries and key international organizations demonstrates the urgency of our challenge. While we don't know if, when, or where a pandemic might strike, we do know that we must be ready. We exist in a time of a wired world and a truly global economy. All of these transformations have created a consciousness of the fact that the global village, first conceived by the great Canadian Marshall McLuhan, is no longer a theory, it's a fact. The world is rapidly embracing such change, but the community of nations has been less swift in coming to grips with the globalization of disease and that fact that we share a common health space. In this 21st century context, getting ready for global disease outbreaks poses unique challenges. It is not only people, goods, and services which travel with ease across borders, so does disease. And with the rise of internet communications and 24-hour news networks, perhaps nothing travels faster than bad news. Readiness is not something countries can achieve on their own. It will require the kind of global collaboration we hope to build and strengthen as our meeting progresses. As ministers of health, we are uniquely positioned to raise the political profile of this urgent matter of global health security and to foster support within our own jurisdictions for the various international collaborations already underway. And our collective political engagement, including our discussions over the next 2 days, will be fundamental to furthering global preparedness. But globally, we have already made an excellent start together. Examples of cooperation include the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Preparedness Plan and the International Partnership on Avian and Pandemic Influenza, recently announced by the United States. Our work will also lend impetus to the upcoming WHO Partners Meeting and the APEC Economic Leaders Meeting, both of which are taking place next week. Indeed, the presence here in Ottawa of high-level delegations from the WHO, the FAO, the OIE, the UN, the World Bank, and the ASEAN Secretariat will ensure that our deliberations will provide meaningful support for other international collaborations. By the end of tomorrow's discussion, we hope to find agreement on what needs to be done in 4 key areas. These are enhancing intersectoral collaboration on issues affecting animal and human health, improving surveillance techniques to detect and identify viruses and building capacity in affected countries, strengthening risk communications capabilities, and boosting the development of supply and accessibility of vaccines and antiviral medications. You will have seen the background papers on these themes circulated in advance of our meeting. Tomorrow, we will also consider a number of related issues, such as the resource and technical complexities involved in a truly global effort of partners. I want to underline that Canada's long-standing interest in hosting this meeting stems from a long-standing commitment to international cooperation and multilateral action. Today's meeting is also a result of meetings and conversations I've had with many of you who are here today. I should also highlight that Canada has been actively involved in revising the WHO's international health regulations aimed at helping stem the spread of diseases. We also believe that a key international priority must be to work with multilateral institutions to build capacity in the countries that have been hardest hit by infectious diseases. Toward that end, for example, Canada has recently invested $15 million in the WHO Canada-Asia Regional Emerging Infectious Disease Project. Our National Microbiology Lab in Winnipeg is working bilaterally with Vietnam's National Institute of Hygiene and Epidemiology to improve their testing capability for avian influenza. As well, Prime Minister Martin recently joined his APEC colleagues in calling for concerted efforts to build and share knowledge, develop networks, systems and protocols, improve the transfer of information, and strengthen supply lines and infrastructure. We also participate, as you know, in the Global Health Security Initiative and serve as the secretariat for the group. We must and we will build upon and strengthen such collaborations. In 2003, the SARS virus emerged in Asia, killing hundreds and exacting a huge economic toll. The identification of Canadian cases underlined the need for strong public health programs. To that end, Canada has created a public health agency and appointed a chief public health officer for Canada. We've also developed a pandemic influenza plan, which is recognized by our international colleagues for its comprehensiveness. Perhaps one of the most valuable lessons we've learned from our experience with SARS was the importance of global action. We cannot allow national boundaries to restrict and constrain our efforts. Only by sharing our knowledge, experience, and resources can we succeed. Moreover, we must do so today. The fact that we are acting now on the threat of a potential pandemic rather than reacting later to a real one underscores our collective resolve. Further, the unique mix of countries from around the globe, north, south, east, west, will help shape the type of discussion we are seeking around fundamental challenges that the world is facing. So to conclude, it gives me great pleasure to formally open this international meeting of health ministers and multilateral organizations. I'm looking forward to our dialogue, and I thank you once again for being here. I would now like to introduce the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee began his term as Director General in July 2003. He has worked at the WHO at the country, regional, and headquarters levels for 20 years in a variety of capacities, notably leading the fight against two of the greatest challenges to health and development, tuberculosis and vaccine-preventable diseases in children. Under Dr. Lee's leadership, preparing the world for an influenza pandemic has become a WHO priority. He has stressed the need for coordinated and effective action to reduce the negative impacts an influenza pandemic would otherwise cause. Dr. Lee will now say a few words. Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Minister Dosanjh. Well, ministers and the colleagues, I'd like to thank the Government of Canada for hosting this important global pandemic influenza readiness meeting. First, I'd like to make it crystal clear, also for the benefit of the media, that what we are talking about today. There are three kinds of influenza we are dealing with these days. The first is a seasonal flu, for which a vaccine exists. I had my flu shot last week, and I urge all of you to have yours. The second is, of course, avian flu, which affects the bird. Over 140 million birds has been culled or died of avian flu. Also, 120 people have been infected with the avian flu through contact with the poultry, of whom 62 have died. Thirdly, there is global pandemic influenza, which we have seen three times in the past century, but we have not seen in this century. Our concern is that the avian flu could become the source of next human influenza pandemic. The big question is, will there be a human influenza pandemic? The short answer is yes. When will it come? I don't know. But it could appear at any time. That is what we are preparing for. That is why we are here. Out of the six phases described by WHO, we are now in phase three. Phase six is a full pandemic. In phase three, a virus new to humans is causing infection, but that virus does not spread easily among humans. The 62 confirmed deaths that have occurred so far in four countries in Asia have been caused by humans catching H5N1, the virus causing the bird form of influenza. So, why are we raising the alarm? Because once a flu virus is able to infect humans easily and spread rapidly, it will cause a pandemic. The information we have so far shows this bird flu virus to be gradually changing. flu viruses are famous for their adaptability. Every time H5N1 infects an animal or human, it has the opportunity to change and improve its transmissibility. The next pandemic flu virus in humans is most likely to come from a development in this avian flu virus. It is spreading rapidly. So what needs to be done? We have to reduce the risk that timely and transparent outbreak reporting and minimizing infection in poultry by culling infected flocks and fairly compensating farmers are crucial part of the solution. At the same time, we must reduce human exposure to the bird flu virus. This limits the opportunities for the virus to change. We also have to use the available vaccine against normal seasonal flu to its maximum extent to reduce the opportunities for mixing up of avian flu virus and seasonal flu virus to occur. We have to make preparedness plans in advance. Once the virus has gone pandemic, it will be too late to prepare. There will only be time to react. Now is the time to put a plan in place. WHO has sent guidance to each country on what to do, but so far, only 40 countries are ready with a plan. Every government must be able to respond rapidly and effectively when the time comes. Stockpiles of antivirals are one part of this picture. We must find ways of helping developing countries. Each country should have access to antiviral medication, whether procured independently or provided through international collaboration in a stockpile. We have to improve surveillance, get early warning systems running in all affected and at-risk countries. These will warn us so that we can quickly dispatch the antiviral stockpiles and take other public health response measures that will stop or limit the spread of infection. We need a rapid and clear picture of what is happening. All countries need to be able to detect, investigate, and report cases without a delay. That information has to be quickly produced and shared freely among the international community. There was no advance warning for the three pandemics of the previous century. This time must be different. Everyone needs to know what to do. Good communication is going to be a key to success or failure. In each phase, communication, especially risk communication, is vital. This is the best way to put the populations on guard and help communities to act responsibly. Resources need to go to the vaccine development. The best protection of all is an effective vaccine. But this can only be made once the pandemic virus has emerged. We currently do not have a vaccine that we know will be fully effective. Nor is there sufficient manufacturing capacity at present. The world will need to produce billions of doses of a safe vaccine when the time comes. This is a huge challenge, but much can be done to prepare. The lead time between the emergence of a virus and the production of the vaccine must be as short as possible to minimize the death toll. There are no immediate and easy solutions to these issues, but they must be resolved. No government or nor head of states can afford to be caught off guard. The expected political, economic, and the social cost of a pandemic will be huge. SARS taught some useful lessons. The economic cost of SARS has been estimated at $30 billion. Yet, remember, there were fewer than 800 deaths throughout the whole outbreak. In summary, there are several outstanding capacity and resource issues. In surveillance, the need are a better surveillance for disease in animals and humans, field investigation, diagnostic support, and incentives for people to report. In production capacity, antivirals may be able to help to contain infection in the event of a pandemic, but supplies of Tamiflu are currently inadequate. Producers of a vaccine against the seasonal flu can only make enough for current demand. This is a fraction of what would be needed for production of global supplies of a vaccine against a pandemic influenza. The world needs a vaccine specific to pandemic influenza. Investment is needed in research and in manufacturing capacity. I applaud effort and the progress made by US NIH on development of a prototype vaccine based on H5N1 virus, which is now on a field trial. International collaboration is essential for success. We have to confront the capacity and the resource issues, and we have to fill the gaps. This meeting gives us an opportunity to address this point in Geneva from 7th to 9th of November at the meeting of meeting on avian flu and the pandemic influenza. You will have the chance to take those concerns to the next stage. I believe this is a time to act. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Now, Dr. Doof, who's been head of the Food and Agricultural Organization since January 1994. He's a native of Senegal. Dr. Diouf served as his country's ambassador to the United Nations from 1991 to 1993. And has held a number of other positions, including representative for Africa to the Consultative Group on International Agriculture Research based in Washington, D.C. He will now say a few words about FAO's contribution to influenza control strategies. Dr. Diouf.
Mr. Minister, Your Excellencies, let me first express on behalf of FAO and myself our appreciation to the Government of Canada for taking the initiative to organize this important meeting. Let there be no mistake about it. Avian influenza is a dangerous and devastating disease. Every effort, therefore, must be made to stop it in its tracks. Avian influenza is dangerous because it can and has moved from domestic poultry to humans in over 100 documented cases, causing, as Dr. Lee just said, the death of some 62 people. If it mutates, as could happen, in a way that allows easy transmission from human to human, we face the very real threat of a pandemic. Since late 2003, avian influenza has been devastating to several countries in Southeast Asia, where over 140 million chicken and ducks have died from the disease or have been culled. The economies of those countries have suffered greatly, with lost revenue estimated at over $10 billion. In the affected countries, 200 million depend on poultry for their livelihoods, and nearly 80% of the population live in rural areas. As if these were not bad enough, the disease is spreading, with many overlapping flyways. Migratory birds could introduce the disease into domestic poultry in Central Europe, the Balkans, the Near East and Africa, and from there to Western Europe and even to the Americas. While little can be done to control the disease in wild birds, much can be done to halt its spread in domestic poultry, which is the current source for human infection and the source of the economic devastation. If I could leave only one message with you today, it would be to double and redouble your efforts to stop avian influenza at its source in animals before it affects humans and before it further decimates rural communities. Prevention of a human pandemic first requires effective disease control in poultry. To combat avian influenza at its source, FAO has a multi-pronged approach. First and perhaps foremost, we are working with countries to strengthen their veterinary services and to improve local capacity at farm and market levels in order, one, to implement biosecurity measures aimed at preventing the disease, two, to improve the surveillance and detection of it, and three, once detected, to control it and to limit its spread. There are proven practices for these, such as isolating poultry, good farm hygiene, use of effective vaccines, close monitoring, and quick culling when necessary. These practices work, and there are success stories in many countries. FAO has been providing advice on how to apply these practices, offering training courses, developing guidelines and manuals, helping equip veterinary laboratories, accessing vaccines, and assisting countries in the design of prevention and control strategies. A second facet of our work deals with regional networking and information sharing. We have helped start regional networks for improving surveillance and diagnosis of avian influenza and for exchanging information on the occurrence of the disease and on lessons learned in combating it. FAO has always stressed the importance of timely reporting of outbreaks and sharing of epidemiological data and samples. This is crucial to analyze the characteristics of the viruses in order to understand and control the disease and prevent human infection. FAO and OIE have jointly appealed to governments to improve the exchange of viral strains between veterinary and human health scientific communities, and we have naturally worked closely with WHO in that. The third dimension of FAO's work is to provide technical information globally and to advocate for an international campaign against the disease. We provide regular information updates through our website and through various publications, technical articles, and press releases. We have also met with and written to multilateral and bilateral donors and government officials in an effort to sound the alarm and mobilize action. At this point, it is important for me to stress that FAO is not working in isolation. Partnerships are critical. In particular, FAO is in very close partnership with WHO and OIE. Jointly, we have developed a global strategy for the progressive control of highly pathogenic avian influenza, and we are working hand in glove to implement it. We are also working with other UN partners, bilateral donors, NGOs, and of course, with the newly initiated UN coordinating mechanism under the leadership of David Nabarro. We look forward to collaborating with the initiative of the Government of Canada, as well as the international partnership recently announced by the United States. Lastly, also FAO's financial resources are limited. We have been able to devote $5.5 million toward this crisis in Asia, and we are now freeing up another $2 million of our own resources to address the spread of the disease outside Asia. However, The global strategy that I mentioned called for additional aid of some $150 to $175 million over 3 years. So far, about $25 million has been pledged. And in this regard, I warmly thank those governments who have already made commitments and invite others to follow their leadership. To conclude, let me reiterate that as the world takes prudent measures to prepare for a major human pandemic, greater measures must be taken to stop this disease in its tracks at its source, which is in animals. This is very possible. It can be done. FAO looks forward to continuing to work with all of you to make it happen. I thank you for your kind attention.
Dr. Diouf, thank you very much. I'm now going to introduce to you Dr. Tierman, who's advisor to the Director General of the World Organization for Animal Health, OIE, Bernard Vallet. As the institution responsible for animal health, the OIE is key to international efforts to prevent an influenza pandemic that spreads from animals to humans. Dr. Tierman is a native of Chile. He received his DVM degree from the University of Chile and a PhD degree from the School of Medicine at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Dr. Tierman.
Honorable Minister Dosan, honorable delegates, Directors General of WHO and FAO, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor and pleasure for the World Organization for Animal Health, and for me in particular on behalf of Dr. Bernard Vallet, to have this opportunity to participate in such a prestigious, timely and crucial meeting. I wish to start my short intervention by a very simple reminder. The current avian influenza virus has not yet demonstrated the ability to easily spread from human to human. Therefore, there's still time for preventive action, and we must concentrate our efforts on reducing the risk of human exposure from infected poultry, and thereby minimizing the chances of the virus evolving into a pandemic form. There's a correlation between environmental load of pathogenic H5N1 virus and the likelihood of a genetic evolution to a pandemic form. I would like to categorize the potential evolution of this virus from a disease in poultry to a pandemic form into four basic steps. The first step, from wildlife to domestic poultry, this step has proven difficult to prevent and is likely to be the most prolific pathway for the continued spread of viral strains of primary significance to animal and public health. The presence of H5 and H7 strains of the virus in wild birds is not new. However, we are dealing with an H5N1 of high pathogenicity and spread. Emphasis must continue to be placed on heightened surveillance of those domestic poultry populations at risk from direct contact with migratory waterfowl. Equally, investment in awareness and biocontainment provide further opportunity to mitigate further progression of the outbreak. The second step, from poultry to poultry, our experience in Southeast Asia has demonstrated that in countries where there was early and transparent reporting and stamping out with or without vaccination, as well as the adequate implementation of biocontainment measures, this transmission can be reduced and eventually broken. The third step, from poultry to humans. This is a critical step. It can be prevented by reducing the level of infection in poultry and by raising awareness of the ways of disease transmission among farmers and the rural population at large. And finally, the last step, from human to humans. While it is impossible to predict whether, and if so, when, H5N1 strains new host adaptation will occur, it can certainly be minimized or delayed by timely intervention in the first three steps, as well as with the rapid deployment of antiviral and vaccines to the sites when and where the first human clusters appear. While it is very important to continue to improve the tools to prevent and treat human infections, our first line of defense should be the attack of the problem at the poultry level. Early detection and rapid response is crucial in the successful control of infection in poultry. We must firstly dedicate our efforts to strengthening the capacity of affected countries and countries at risk to carry out the necessary surveillance for avian influenza in the poultry populations. However, for these activities to be effective, we must ensure close collaboration between the public health and the animal health sector. This must begin at the local level and throughout the entire chain of communication in order to minimize the spread of H5N1 virus among animals and from animals to man. We must also continue to jointly develop and revise our avian influenza preparedness plans. It is important to note that many of the countries affected so far have been developing countries with limited resources. It is therefore imperative for the global community and the international organizations present here today to urgently mobilize needed resources for this improved surveillance both in animals and humans, and to provide economic incentives to promote early detection and transparent reporting. The OIE and the FAO have taken the leadership role in creating a global framework for the progressive control of transboundary animal diseases, so-called GFTAT, based on coordination at regional level. In cases of zoonosis, WHO joins this GFTAT framework in the preparation and execution of the Global Early Warning and Response System for Transboundary Animal Diseases, so-called GLUS. This program involves verification, validation, and exchange of disease intelligence information and the epidemiological interpretation thereof. This joint analysis of data and mapping of avian influenza risks along the food chain and the consequent application of risk mitigating strategies based on the international standards set out by the OIE are of great value in the containment of the infection. Much more medium and long-term strategic material input is required for countries and regions to be in sufficiently strong position to avert further damage to the industry and to global human health. The strategic documents just mentioned will be the basis for negotiation of much needed incremental resources to be provided by donors to this program. So far, it is our opinion that the international community has drastically underinvested in the veterinary infrastructure required to support this vitally important program, estimated at less than 20% of requirements. In addition to raising the awareness of the health risk and the importance of rapid and transparent notification of the occurrence of disease in poultry, we must also create an incentive for reporting, both at the farmer level and by countries. Incentives for the former are likely to include compensation for losses, as well as capacity building towards alternative systems for poultry keeping and marketing of live birds. We must encourage and reward countries to report outbreaks by promoting the OIE standards, which recommend the appropriate science-based measures to protect human and animal health and safe trade of poultry and poultry products, while minimizing trade barriers. Excessive and unjustified trade restrictions imposed on countries who have demonstrated transparent reporting and adequate disease control will invariably lead to unwarranted economic consequences that directly will serve as deterrents to transparency in the future. I believe that particularly during the zoonotic crisis, we may need to rapidly strengthen the veterinary infrastructures of all countries and thereby the ability for early detection and rapid response to emerging diseases. Today, we are here developing common strategies to fight avian influenza. However, the need for this enhanced surveillance capability will not end with the control of avian influenza. As has been the case in recent decades, we will continue to be confronted by new emerging and re-emerging diseases, most of which will be coming from animals, as has been the case with Nipah, West Nile virus, Ebola, and SARS. It is also important for us to coordinate risk assessment and communication among public health and animal health officials, as well as among countries, in order to keep the public informed, avoiding panic, misinformation, and prevent unnecessary economic and social disruption. The conference, which will take place in Geneva in 2 weeks, will be a crucial opportunity to decide on the investment for capacity building and targeting available resources to developing and implementing a winning strategy for the control of avian influenza in animals and the prevention of pandemic influenza in humans. I would be remiss if I did not recognize and extend thanks to Canada for the level of contribution in support of activities of the OIE, and to the Government of Canada for the leadership and the sponsorship of this initiative, and to all of you here for the commitment to this global public good initiative. Let us recognize and embrace the complementarity of competencies necessary to address the avian influenza threat and future emerging zoonoses to come. Ladies and gentlemen, we must be prepared for a potential pandemic, but we must fight this war on avian influenza on its animal source and now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Thiemann. Thank you. Ian?
This is the end of the televised portion of the conference. Delegates in the CADU room next door will continue to receive the feed. Dr. Chan will be using the screen for her presentation. So as Dr. Chan is introduced, I would invite colleagues at this end of the table to move to the chairs in the pit. I would suggest from China over to Italy.